Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Organizing around food can address the intersection of many critical social justice issues and transform communities. In his new book, Food Town USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat, food writer Mark Winney invites readers on a tour of America's most surprising and inspiring destinations in food. As he travels from Portland, Maine and Sitka, Alaska, and many places in between, he highlights how a healthy, sustainable fare movement is changing communities and revitalizing towns across the country that have been impacted by inequity, obesity, and the opioid epidemic. Today, we talk with Mark Winney about how food has become an unexpected force for change. Mark, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
You say your book is about seven unlikely cities that are changing the way we eat. Now, why did you choose the cities that you chose? In fact, some listeners here in Portland may be surprised that you chose the other Portland as a place to talk about the importance of food, whole food system. So why the cities that you chose? Why didn't you choose Portland, Oregon?
I realize that could be a sacrilegious choice in this case. But I chose Portland, Maine, and Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Youngstown, Ohio, Jacksonville, Florida, Boise, Idaho, Sitka, Alaska, and Alexandria, Louisiana, because I was interested in going to places that were not on the so-called foodie radar, you know, that were considered perhaps interesting places in their own right, but for which food had not really made a big impression either there or elsewhere. And I was also looking for some regional diversity in my choice of cities. I was looking for, you know, places that had different climates. And I also had, given that I've been in the food world and the food network for quite a while, I had, you know, connections in some places which helped me actually find my way around. I had some good guides that made my job a lot easier, and I was able to ferret out some really good stories.
Well, I certainly will say that you have. Now, just kind of getting back to the other Portland, the one here that I'm sitting in right now, as I was reading the descriptions of these towns, particularly Boise, Idaho, which is the closest of the food towns that you talk about to where we're sitting right now, or where I'm sitting right now, I remember when I first came to Portland in 1971, it was probably more like Boise, Idaho in terms of the food scene. I mean, there were hardly any good restaurants, and there was, it seemed like a very, because I came from the Bay Area and before that from New York, so I was used to, like, you know, really great cuisine. It wasn't here in Portland, but what there were a lot of food co-ops. And in fact, it was the first place I ever lived where there was storefront food co-ops, which were, I think, the beginning of a real burgeoning food movement in Portland. The other thing that Portland had back then, which was a surprise to me, was farms were ringing the city, and there were lots of people who were growing amazing gardens in their backyards around Portland. And I think that, a lot of people, I mean, Portland has a reputation now of being one of the food meccas of North America, and in some ways it is. And in fact, I liked in your book talking to people in Boise who they say, well, we're not Portland, as if, I guess, they're always feeling that kind of comparison. But it made me think about how when a city is at the state that any of the cities that you describe in your book are, that they can become like a really amazing center for like food innovation, for a whole changing awareness of the importance of food in our lives, and also a way of creating alternative systems of food to the corporate food agribusiness that we're so familiar with. So I wanted to start by talking about how you saw that. And I'd like to start actually with the first city in your book, which is Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which would surprise anybody because most of us think of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania as a city that kind of went away when the steel industry went away in America. So what is happening in Bethlehem and what makes it so special?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, the dark part of the story is that it almost went away. It you know, nearly collapsed when the steel industry collapsed. Bethlehem Steel, which, you know, basically takes its name from the city. 30,000 people were out of work over the course of just a few years in the mid to late 90s. And so a city, you know, that almost disappeared has to try to reinvent itself if it wants to continue to exist. And in the case of Bethlehem, there were several parts of the story that brought about its renaissance, but certainly a big part of it was the arts and food, which I think is surprising. How does arts and food replace steel? And that was not an unusual story for a a set of events in other cities that I visited. Something unusual takes the place of something that had been sort of the iconic, characterization of a particular place. So Bethlehem, people began to realize that, that it was not that far from New York City, a little over an hour. That was an advantage in some respects. They also realized that, they didn't have to get rid of all evidence of steel. They could actually repurpose many of the buildings that were there. And they also had some amazing old neighborhoods, which were on the brink of becoming impoverished, given the fact of the loss of jobs and the loss of the industry. But they also had a really tremendous base of people from all over the world who had traditionally come to Bethlehem to work in the steel mills, but they could cook, and they had a culinary tradition that had not yet been fully expressed. And they began to nurture some of that capacity. People with Peruvian backgrounds, Puerto Rican backgrounds, El Salvadorian backgrounds, even Ethiopian, and new restaurants, small ethnic mom and pop type restaurants began to emerge. They also had a very rich tradition of agriculture, being in the middle of the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, and farmers markets and farm-to-table restaurants and farm-to-school programs all began to emerge coming out of that long-standing tradition of agriculture. So people began to basically utilize what was there. What did they have that they could build on and not have to create something brand new? So a new identity began to emerge, which was largely based on food and also the arts. They actually found synergy between those things. I'll give you one example, which is the beginning of a charter school that was dedicated to the arts. And they started this school in the middle of downtown Bethlehem, not more than a stone's throw from the old steel mills. And this was 4 years ago. And 650 students from the Lehigh Valley come to this one place every day to do art education. And they were providing a demand for the food that was available, that was becoming available in downtown Bethlehem. So, 650 students, their parents and friends who would come to performances 90 nights out of the year, there was a performance at the school. They ate out. So they built on each other. That supply and demand relationship was deliberately established through the presence of the charter arts school. So it's really building on what's there, sort of re-identifying it, what is already a strength, and then how do you enhance it? And at the same time, there was some really good city leadership that nurtured these ideas.
Actually, I want to get more into that because, that's one of the things as you're talking, I keep wondering, well, what was the germination for all this? Like something had to be a catalytic moment. And I wondered how much of it was just people coming together and how much of it was that there was, in fact, some leadership, whether it was from the community or from government officials.
I would have to say that it wasn't any one person or one event other than the fact that they had to come up with something to survive. But there was one city councilwoman whose name is Olga Negron, a Puerto Rican woman who also became the first Latina elected to the Bethlehem City Council, who really saw the potential for both arts and food to drive the renaissance of Bethlehem. And she began poking and pushing and talking and she was already an activist in many respects, but she put food and arts at the center of their development efforts. So, but you can't, in all of these cases, you can't necessarily point to one person or one event. It was often dozens of people coming together around the same time and creating almost a gravitational pull among each other that was became the genesis of food as a way to reestablish an identity within a city.
Well, while this is happening, one of the concerns a lot of people have who live in areas that are, you know, disappearing, so to speak, because of loss of jobs and loss of economic focus, once they're rediscovered by artists and by foodies and by counterculture people, then the next wave of people that come are the gentrifiers. And is that a problem in Bethlehem? Is Bethlehem getting gentrified now?
To a lesser degree, it is. For instance, I mean, there's housing in the area, the downtown area, that, you know, had been, I mean, houses that had been abandoned, properties that had been neglected, rents were at an all-time low. Houses were selling for $20,000 a piece. Now those same houses are going for $200,000 to $300,000. So it is a concern, you know, that does, is food and arts and other activities that improve the quality of life of a community a threat? And it's an interesting question, and it's one that certainly came up in many of the cases. You know, where there an exciting food scene began to emerge, you could begin to see an increase in housing prices, in rents, in fact, changing the overall complexion and the economic makeup of the community. But at the same time, I found people paying attention to those factors and trying to mitigate the whatever negative impact, you know, a strong, high-quality food and art scene was generating. And at the same time, people were also doing the best they could to be inclusive. They were trying to make sure that everybody was benefiting. You know, the example I give in Bethlehem where, you know, these weren't necessarily, you know, white tablecloth, high-end restaurants that are going in. These were ones that were owned and operated by people who lived there, and using their own culinary traditions, and they were being supported by economic development initiatives that were coming out of the region, out of the economic development work in the Lehigh Valley. So there was, in fact, a great deal of sensitivity toward you know, the people who were there and trying to make sure that they weren't being pushed out.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG and LPFM, and we've just added KODX LPFM in Seattle as well. And today we're talking with Mark Winnie, who's author of Foodtown USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way That We Eat. Well, there seems to be, from what I sensed from your book, actually two Bethlehems. There's the one downtown, but there's another side of Bethlehem, too, which maybe is a little bit more challenged than the downtown scene?
Well, it's what they call the south side. I think that's what you're referring to. And that's, when I say downtown, that really is kind of the heart of the city. It's really the south side. You know, an interesting factor is so many, the role that rivers and waters, bodies of water played, cities were often divided by a river, and on one side was more well off than the other side, or one side had a different ethnic identity than the other. And that was certainly the case in Bethlehem. A river ran through it, and on the south side of the river, you know, it was certainly the lower income part of the city. But that, I think, also, you know, was where the economic development was targeted, and that's where a lot of the new food activity began to receive, you know, more support, more financial, more funding support, more economic development assistance. You also began to see a growth in community gardens and farmers markets in those areas as well. There was also a tremendous amount of concern about food access. These places had been, or in some cases still remain, food deserts, meaning that they don't have, people there don't have easy access to fresh, affordable food outlets. And so the south side of Bethlehem has been targeted for the development of new supermarkets, one of which is up and operating, and they're hoping to get another one sometime in the future. So again, I came away feeling that yes, there are many challenges still remaining in these places, but people were paying attention to those challenges and in some cases had made some really significant progress.
Well, I want to move to another city which has a lot of the same problems as Bethlehem, but it seemed from your book that it's got a very different outcome so far. And that's Youngstown, Ohio, which is not that far from Bethlehem, actually. But let's that's talk right. about the similarities and the differences between those two towns.
Yeah, I mean, Youngstown was, of the seven cities I visited and wrote about, Youngstown was the most challenging. And it was, I got to the point where I said, I don't think this city is going to prove my point. My hypothesis is going to be undercut by the difficulties that Youngstown is having.
By the way, what was your hypothesis?
My hypothesis was that food was a critical driver in the development and redevelopment and indeed a renaissance of many cities, and was becoming a significant part of contributing significantly to the quality of life and the economic development of a community. And what I saw in Youngstown in comparison to the other six cities was a place that was still struggling. It was one vast food desert. There were no supermarkets. It was socially and economically very challenged. There were some large institutions, in the case of Youngstown University, which was not playing a very important and significant role in the redevelopment of the city of Youngstown, unlike institutions in the other cities, which were also very important players in bringing back cities. But what I did find in a way which kind of came back to supporting my hypothesis, which was that I talked to so many people who were trying various kinds of food projects and food activities to make a difference. And I also found a tremendous number of young people, both current residents of Youngstown as well as former residents of Youngstown, who were coming back. You know, I called it the return of the millennials, who decided that, you know, they had been disenchanted with their hometown and they wanted to get out. They went to college or somewhere else, but eventually they came back. And they were receiving some enticements to do so, such as houses that were going for $15,000 each. And they were the ones who were often leading the charge for a new kind of food scene. They were establishing farmers markets. They were becoming farmers in or near Youngstown and were growing food for people there, selling at farmers markets. In some cases, they were establishing new coffee shops and restaurants. They were leading nonprofit organizations and foundations that were doing a lot of good work to try to rebuild Youngstown. So that return of the millennials was a very sort of essential ingredient in the the attempt to bring Youngstown back from really the brink of extinction.
Well, I was just watched a movie the other day about Dayton, Ohio, which used to be a really thriving town, which sounds like it's from this movie, similar in a similar situation as Youngstown. And I'm just wondering about some of the other struggles that these communities, particularly in the rusting Rust Belt in Ohio and Pennsylvania, are having that are maybe different from some of the other cities that you talk about, which I think have a little bit more upbeat scenes. What are some of the real challenges in Youngstown besides the fact that there's no food, there's no supermarkets, and there's no economy to speak of?
Well, Youngstown has suffered badly. They, like Bethlehem, they lost their steel industry, but they lost it much earlier in the 1970s. But in recently, just a year ago, General Motors closed down a auto assembly plant in Lordstown, Ohio, which is right next door to Youngstown. 2,000 good-paying union jobs were lost in the course of that shutdown. So the deindustrialization of America was certainly a contributing factor. The difference, I think, and what I found between Bethlehem in Pennsylvania and Youngstown, Ohio, was that the state intervened in the case of Pennsylvania. They were like the cavalry that charged in to try to get things back in shape, and made some investments and tried to help bring a city back, from its very desperate situation. In Ohio, they didn't do that. The state of Ohio was, I would have to say, negligent, if not worse, in the way that they responded to some of the challenges of their major cities. That certainly was the case in Youngstown, I would say, not, and probably similar in other cities in Ohio like Dayton that are challenged as well. It takes a major commitment to rebuild a city when its traditional industries have abandoned the place. Youngstown also suffered from some internal problems, including political corruption and poor leadership. That seems to have turned around with a new mayor and some new vigor, and we can hope that that's going to make a difference. So sometimes they hurt themselves as well. That wasn't the case in Bethlehem. They were able to, mobilize their own political leadership and also their non-governmental leadership and bring people together in a way that was much more constructive. And I'd also say collaborative. I didn't see the degree of collaboration in Youngstown among the different players that I saw in Bethlehem. So I think an important lesson learned from all of my research was the role of collaboration among the key stakeholders, political as well as private sector, private enterprise, for-profit and non-profit. They all have to be at the table and they all have to be working together.
Well, another problem that seemed to be really critical in Dayton, as shown in this documentary, is that there's a massive opioid and now opiate addiction problem, which comes out of, it's sort of the classic situation when you have massive unemployment and industries flee and there's just no basis for hope for a lot of people. Is that a similar problem in Youngstown?
There's a lot of crime, and there were a lot of drugs. Opioids in particular are part of that situation. But I would say that at least as of a few months ago, it was still a crime-ridden city, and it was presenting, and drugs were certainly at the core of what was driving a lot of that crime. So that obviously is a disincentive to people coming back or reinvesting in a place. I did see it, however, and I wrote about this in my section on Portland, Maine, where, and again, this was kind of an old seaport city that has come back to life in a rather very robust fashion. And opioids were a big driver of the decline of that city over the last 10 years or so. And that also was a product of deindustrialization, of major structural changes. But in this case, it was the whole state of Maine that had changed, not just the city of Portland.
Well, I want to talk about Portland now, because that actually was one of the cities that I was a little bit more familiar with. And I grew up not that far. I grew up in Massachusetts, and so I was familiar with Portland growing up. And Portland had a kind of quaintness, and it seemed to me it was never the kind of city that you just kind of shake your head and go, I never want to go there. It seemed to me it had an appeal, though I wound up going to the other Portland when I wound up going where I wanted to live,
right.
Which by 1971 had a little more appeal than Portland, Maine. But it was interesting to be reading your description of what's more recent developments in Portland, Maine. But I was familiar from like 30 years ago. I had a cousin who lived there for a while. And it seemed back even in the late 70s, early 80s, that there was a lot of stuff happening in Portland, Maine. And it was very different from a lot of the other cities that you describe where there was no scene that goes back 30, 40 years of having a kind of cultural awareness and hipness and political liberalness and things like that. So I want to first of all talk about the differences between Portland, Maine and cities like Youngstown and Bethlehem and how that those differences maybe enable the city to have a stronger foot to start out on.
Yeah, I mean, Portland, I speak of this, that I actually went to college in Maine, we were always told that, you know, don't go to Portland. You know, it's a dangerous place. And in the 60s and 70s, it was a tough, brawling, boozy kind of old seaport that, you know, that it didn't rediscover its charm or begin to find its charm again until probably the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. It was always, of course, had some cachet given the fact that everyone loves lobsters and, you know, the Maine seacoast and Maine in the summertime. And so anyone from the greater Northeast would always kind of look to Portland as being that place that you got to visit, you know, you got to pass through, spend a day or two, get a lobster, but move on. Nobody wanted to live there.
Actually,
housing was.
Actually, when my cousin was living there, she said that, I mean, I think there was a certain period where Portland almost became a suburb of Boston because people were referring to it as Portland, Massachusetts. So I wonder how that fits into what happened later, because that didn't sound like a great thing, actually.
Yeah, it was, you know, exactly where and when the transition took place, I can't say for sure. But it was definitely a place that was, you know, on the skids, had a tough drug scene, a lot of alcohol. Alcoholism. There wasn't, you know, the old industries that had been driving not just Portland but Maine were either moving out or shifting. And so I think the story of Portland is it's a place that rediscovered its seaport identity and really built on that, and it became a very attractive place to live. Now here's a case again where rents were cheap. People from around Maine who no longer had jobs because the textile mills had closed had moved to Maine, rather moved to Portland, and were finding cheap places to live. And then suddenly, you know, this city was rediscovered for its seaport charm, and you began to see rents and housing prices go up. New condominiums were being built. And yes, you began to see sort of those people being, you know, the people who had migrated to Portland hoping for a second chance, not finding a good place to live. In part, this began to drive some of the problems that have been seen more recently with opioid addiction. How does a city change? I mean, how does a city transition from, you know, its old image to a time when it's struggling, back to some kind of rebirth, find a new identity at the same time trying to take care of its own people who are there. You know, that to me was sort of an ongoing theme and an ongoing struggle in all the places that I visited.
You're listening to The Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and in Seattle at KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And today we're talking with Mark Winnie, who's author of Food Town USA, 7 Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. Let's talk about the dynamics of what's been going on in Portland for the last few years. Because actually, as I was reading your description of Portland, I kind of wanted to go back and visit it because it was sounding really fascinating. It sounded like there's a really beautiful core to the city, that the history of it has been reclaimed and restored, and that it sounded like there's some really good food to eat there, as well as maybe some really good political organizing going on.
Yes, that's a good way to characterize it. You know, you have some fantastic chefs, you have some fantastic restaurants, and you have some very entrepreneurial people. You know, one of the more intriguing businesses that I came across was a supermarket, small supermarket, independent chain called Rosemont Markets, and six stores in the greater Portland area, opened up by... you know, it opened up about 20 years ago and slowly developed, and really emphasizing locally grown food and becoming a really important sort of driver in using food as a economic development tool, really trying to find how do we get as much value out of it as possible, not just buying from farmers, but, you know, really trying to develop the farmers and the food scene, because they knew that the, you know, their consumers wanted that food, but they wanted to make sure that the quality was there, the reliability of supply was there. So that was very much a driving force and, you know, bringing, you know, a good entrepreneurial example. I was finding several of those examples around Portland. But at the same time, I was finding that kind of entrepreneurship applied to nonprofit work as well, to community development activities. One of which was cultivating communities. It's a larger scale urban gardening and urban farming program. And one of the very interesting features of Portland, and actually Maine more recently, is the influx of refugees from Somalia and Ethiopia and Sudan. And, you know, in fact, the numbers are in the thousands of people that have come into the Portland area, many of them bringing their own agricultural and food traditions with them, and not having, you know, trying to, you can imagine the difficulties of coming from Africa and learning how to grow food in Maine. And this, you know, but cultivating communities worked very closely with these folks to help them develop ways that they could actually grow their own food. So they have a very robust farming and gardening program that's very sensitive to the cultural needs of this very, of these, they call them the new farmers, the new Americans, who are now becoming the leading growers for the greater Portland area. So that's a very exciting way that they've integrated a new group who came into their community.
Well, growing up in New England, I'm familiar with the lousy soil and the challenges of growing food, even like in central Massachusetts, where I grew up. But Maine was the place where the only thing you could grow were potatoes. So I'm wondering, what is growing in Maine now, and how are they getting other things to grow besides potatoes?
I would say that the, you know, they certainly have the same variety of produce that you could imagine in your kind of warm weather seasons, you know, tomatoes and lettuce and so forth. There's been a lot of application of new tech, of sort of low tech solutions such as row covers and tunnel greenhouses and so forth, so that they've been able to extend the growing season in otherwise, in an area that's otherwise pretty challenging. There's been a lot of, I think, just good technical assistance. What are some of the varieties that are better, more adaptable to the Maine climate and Maine growing conditions? And there's also been just a lot of mutual support. You know, it's not always a technological solution which is going to make the difference. Sometimes it's really the social or community connections and the mutual support that comes out of that. And places like Cultivating Community are doing that. And Rosemont Markets is doing it. They're trying to work with farmers to make sure that their growing practices are going to be as productive as possible. I think the thing that I was most lifted up about, I suppose, in Portland and elsewhere, was the way that everyone seems to be helping everyone else. You know, we're not out to be a winner. We're not out to beat the competition. We're out to try to succeed together. Doesn't mean that they're completely altruistic in their approaches, but it does show that there's sort of this culture of community support, of community supported entrepreneurism, so that we can all succeed together. You know, that kind of ethic was, you know, very, very exciting to witness, and I think has promise for how we approach development challenges in other communities.
Well, I want to move as far away from Portland, Maine as you possibly can in your book and go to Sitka, Alaska. Another community that we're tied to here in KBOO, because our former development director is now the station manager of KCAW, which I understand you didn't. I thought you'd talk more about the radio station there, because that radio station plays a really pivotal role in, I think, creating Sitka culture and community. But you did go to a restaurant was in the same building. But I mean, Sitka is an amazing place. I've been here since I'm in radio world, and I know a lot of people who've worked at that station over the years. I've heard a lot about Sitka. So let's talk about how it compares and contrasts to Portland, because they're both basically fishing towns, or Portland used to be a fishing town, Sitka still is, and how how building a food system in Sitka is both similar and maybe more challenging than in the cities that are in the lower 48 states.
Yeah, Sitka's food system is hugely challenging. They have the highest food prices in the U.S., other than perhaps a few more remote communities in Alaska. You know, Sitka's on the, you know, the kind of the lower, the southeast panhandle of Alaska. It's about 800 miles by sea from Seattle. And all of its food, well, 98% of its food is sent in by barge. There are no roads into Sitka. You could only get there by sea or air. You know, this presents huge challenges for anyone, you know, who's going to live there. And, you know, the sense of food vulnerability, of food insecurity, of sort of a threat is palpable in Sitka, unlike other places where people still pretty much take food for granted and, you know, it's available and affordable, et cetera. That's not quite the case in Sitka. When I was visiting, the barge was late by a day or two, which I guess it often is. And you could actually begin to see the grocery store shelves empty out rather quickly when that occurred. But, of course, at the same time, the irony is that it is, you know, situated right on the, you know, one of the most productive fishing grounds in the world. The Sitka Bay and the Gulf of Alaska are hugely productive, even though they are under threat from the environment, from climate change. And that was also a very palpable situation in Sitka when I was there. People were talking about the fact that certain salmon runs were much lower than they had been, or even some had been shut down by the by the regulators, the Alaska fishing regulators, because the supply was so low. The native Alaskans that I spoke with had noted very significant changes in the availability of certain species and changes in salmon runs and herring runs, not just over the last few years, but over decades. So it's in light of that, I think that I was struck by Sitka's desire of its people to work together, to try to be, you know, to be aware of the risk that they are facing, and how do they confront it, and coming together as a community, and having a very active food scene in a town of only 9,000 people was remarkable. So that was, you know, that was the good news, and it's like the, you know, people rise to a certain challenge. And they have some major challenges in Sitka, but I've really was impressed by the way that folks came together. Just one quick example is something they call Planning Day. It's a day in the fall on a Saturday. Anybody who wants to come together and has an idea to make the community better, you know, will come and they sort of present their ideas. People discuss them. They go through a whole process, and eventually they come out with two or three ideas that they want to implement, that the whole community wants to implement. And a little bit of money is put up, a little bit of seed money, not much. But people who come and participate in this event also agree to work on it, become volunteers, and try to provide support. And over the last 10 or 12 years since this process has been underway, probably about 60% of the projects that have been identified are food related, and most of them are still operating today. And you know, they're new farms, new large scale market gardens, I would probably call them, a farmer's market, a tree planting, public tree planting, fruit tree planting project. You know, these are some of the outcomes of the Planning Day, which is also an outcome, I think, or an expression of a rather extraordinary form of community spirit.
Well, speaking of their main source of food along the southeastern part of Alaska is, of course, comes from the ocean. And there's a old tribal mantra, basically, that when the tie goes out, the table is set. And I have a sense that Sitka was once very much like that. I'm wondering if there's still a mount of the table being set when the tie goes out in Sitka, or if the fisheries are crashing so badly now because of climate change that no longer is there this, the kind of abundance that there used to be.
Right. Abundance has given way to scarcity, and particularly if from the point of view of Native Alaskans, you know, for whom subsistence food, meaning food taken from the ocean and from the forests, that food is declining. And there's, in fact, there's both the wisdom of the elders who are speaking to that situation, as well as the science of researchers who are discovering changes in the ocean temperature, changes in the acidity of the ocean, and resulting changes in species. I mean, there are photographs of Sitka Bay, of the herring run in the spring, where it really looks like, going back 100 years, it looks like you could walk across the water on the backs of the herring. Today, there's nothing like that. It's, you know, the scarcity is, compared to those days, is rather extraordinary. We nature gives, and I guess you could say man takes away, because you know much of the fishing that goes on is offshore, catches that are going to Asia and other parts of the world. Very, very little food that fish that was caught in those Alaskan waters is going to people in Alaska, and particularly Sitka. You know, there, even though it is a highly regulated fisheries, the challenges of large-scale commercial fishing, which themselves are an expression of world demand and, you know, a pending food insecurity, are huge. And they're, it's people having a very difficult time getting control over their own natural resources in the Sitka area. Even though fishing is far and away the largest component of their economy, I think it was some 500 commercial fishing boats are licensed in Sitka. So it's a huge part of their industry. It's a huge part of their economy. It's a huge part of their identity. But at the same time, it represents an extraordinary challenge. And it's something that we in the throughout the United States and North America ought to be aware of, because it is that canary in the coal mine with respect to climate change.
Now, are there any efforts to create like fishing co-ops or other things, the other ways in which people in Sitka are organizing to help support a more of a local thriving food scene? Can they do anything to counteract the industrial fishing market that is basically decimating their fishery?
One of the better examples is something called Sitka Salmon Shares. It operates like a community supported agriculture share program where you purchase a share on the farm. And this, the shares and it are actually initially they're owned by the 25 to 30 commercial fishermen who are members of this project, and their catch is going into this program. And they own this together. They are the shareholders, and they own a processing facility right there at Sitka. And the food, the fish is cut and flash frozen, but it is shipped to about 6,000 shareholders in the Midwest, interestingly enough, and who pay a certain amount of money for it to be shareholders to receive mostly salmon throughout the year. The deal is that the fishermen are getting a much better price because they're, you know, controlling the catch and the processing. They're using absolutely the best environmental practices, sustainable fishing practices that are available. And there's also a tremendous amount of education directed at the shareholders themselves, the consumers, so that they understand what's going on with the fisheries. And that, I think, is an important element of that project. So everyone's benefiting in that respect, but it's still only a small part of small answer to a much bigger problem. One other very small example, which I enjoyed, was something called fish to school, or fishermen to school, and whereby the public schools in Sitka are getting salmon donated, sometimes sold at a very low price, directly from the commercial fishermen, and going right into the school. So the kids are getting like the best, best food, best salmon, best protein available, as fresh as it can be. Even that has some financial challenges, but it's a way that they're trying to make sure that everybody benefits, even though it's a small program, but it's a good example of what you can do when people decide they're going to work together to try to solve problems.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and in Seattle at KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And we're talking today with Mark Winnie, who's author of Food Town USA, Seven Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. Well, speaking of climate change, let's go back to Florida and Jacksonville, which also has, was surprising to me that Jacksonville has such a lively food scene. Let's talk a little bit about the ups and the downs of that scene.
Yes. Well, Jacksonville was hit by two hurricanes, 2016 and 2017. Irma in 2017 was particularly destructive. As I said at the beginning of this discussion, water is very much a big part of what goes on, and it's something we ignore at our own peril. Rivers may divide a city, but waters can also consume a city. In the case of Jacksonville, during Hurricane Irma, that was a big part of the story. The St. John's River, which runs right through the middle of Jacksonville, simply rose up 6, 7, 8 feet above its normal level and engulfed neighborhoods around Jacksonville, some of which are not going to be rebuilt. Decisions that were made that it's not no longer affordable to try to rebuild and ensure certain areas. The ocean, of course, is very close. I saw a very large and beautiful community garden at a food bank that was wiped out by the rising ocean during the hurricane, when the shoreline itself was a mile away. I saw a farm that was 10 miles inland that was engulfed by water that rose up literally out of the ground because there was no apparent body of water nearby, no lakes or rivers or ponds. The water table is so high, so close to the top of the ground, that when there's additional pressure and water pressure, it just simply rises up and drowns everything around it. So it's a huge threat. And I wouldn't say it's one yet that the city of Jacksonville and the other and Florida is taking as seriously as it could, but it is certainly a big part of the discussion among food organizations and food system players. The food bank has numerous emergency procedures that it now has to include in its ongoing operations in order to be prepared for the next big hurricane, which is certainly everyone is expecting will happen in the not too distant future. I would say another shifting away from the environment for a moment, and something we haven't talked about yet, but I found it emerging in different ways in most of my communities, was the issue of racism and racial divides. And that was apparent almost everywhere, but it was particularly magnified in Jacksonville, which has a very large section of its city, this one called the North Side. In Bethlehem, it was the South Side. In Jacksonville, the North Side is a very large, most 95% African-American community, which is also far and away one of the biggest food deserts I've ever seen. You can look at a map of supermarkets all over the greater Jacksonville area, and you will not find a single dot and a single indication of a supermarket in the North Side, other than a couple of very small grocery stores. So that kind of neglect, racial divide, inequality is very pervasive. But I also found a very vibrant food scene in the North Side, a very vibrant African-American culinary traditions that were emerging and becoming significant commercial forces that were in a way counterbalancing some of the emergence of an exciting food scene in the largely white parts of Jacksonville. And, you know, some early progress in beginning to work together to bring those two scenes together to see if there wasn't a way they could collaborate more effectively. So, you know, the poverty, racism, very definite factors that influence people's diets, influence the access to healthy and affordable food, was a big deal in Jacksonville. But it was also one that people were finally beginning to pay attention to.
Well, one of the challenges that I've seen in the work that I've done around food systems and the food movement is the contradictions and the kind of culture clashes between communities that come from other parts of the world or other parts of the United States that are not mainstream, that have food traditions that are very high in fat, high in sugar, high in salt, high in things that will basically exacerbate whatever health conditions you might experience because of other reasons why your community is marginalized. And I know that's true. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Richmond, California, which you might want to visit if you do an appendage to this book, which has Richmond, California is an amazing food scene. It's also been an extremely marginalized city. And it isn't deindustrialized because it has Chevron, which is in a whole other set of problems, but it's highly, highly polluted. But they have one of the most amazing food scenes I've ever seen, both urban gardens and a whole lot of other community networks. But they are dealing with diabetes and asthma and all kinds of health issues, which are exacerbated by eating, whether it's eating soul food or it's eating Filipino food or it's eating a lot of Latino food. So I wonder how that is synthesized and kind of how I'm particularly interested in Jacksonville about how you incorporate the local foodways at the same time that you try to infuse that with little healthier ways of cooking and also choices of food.
Well, you know, frankly, I had a conversation with an African-American woman who was a leading food activist in Jacksonville. In particular in terms of policy and health, works with the public health department. And I said, you know, I found some really exciting, fantastic food enterprises in the North Side, you know, that showed a lot of promise and was creating a lot of good financial activity, economic activity, was bringing the community together, was a real strong expression of African-American cuisine, and supporting its sort of cultural existence. But the food they were eating was problematic at best. And I raised these issues with her, and she said, yes, that's the challenge we face. You know, we have, we want to support the culinary traditions of the African-American community, but we have to find new expressions for it that are healthier. And you began to see that there was some emergence of some, you know, soul food, vegan restaurants. There was also a very robust program to provide additional benefits to people in the SNAP program. We refer to it as Double Up Bucks or Farm Fresh coupons, incentives for people in the SNAP / food stamp program to buy healthy food at farmers markets. You know, that was a very strong component of what was going on. But I think the sensitivity around activists and others in North Florida was very much around that problem, around that challenge that, you know, the diet, the sort of traditional diet is a part of the problem that people are facing, that it is going to have long-term health consequences already in terms of obesity and diabetes and other diet-related illnesses.
Well, Mark, we only have a couple moments left, but I wonder if, to sum up this, what your experiences in writing this book, researching and writing it, do you feel that your thesis that food is like an important building block in building communities and revitalizing cities, do you think that you supported that thesis, or were there some holes punctured in it?
I think it was supported. I think my thesis was strengthened by, as I dug into it, I found out what the connective tissue was, the way that food can be used, particularly when City Hall or your elected officials look at the environment around them. Mayors always want to, tout the quality of life in their community. They want to talk about the jobs they are creating. They want to talk about what a wonderful place my city is to live. Well, those elected officials who recognized that food was an important player in the quality of life in their community, they were the ones that were having the most success. Those communities were really coming together and supporting both a dynamic food scene that was raising the quality of life for everybody, but was also making sure that they were taking care of their own, those who were not yet achieving the kind of social and economic success that others were. So that was certainly, a part of my learning that I think was sharpened as I realized the role that City Hall can play in building a community. I also recognized that sort of the mutuality of local people who have an idea of what a food system is and how effective it can be to support the development of your place. And when you come together and you're sort of intentionally working collaboratively toward a common vision, a common goal, things begin to happen that would never happen otherwise.
Okay.
So that,
thanks
me,
a whole lot.
The big points.
Mark, thanks a whole lot for joining us. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking today with Mark Winnie, who's author of Food Town USA, 7 Unlikely Cities That Are Changing the Way We Eat. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And if you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our Kibwe Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week will be preempted for MLK Day. The following week, we'll be talking with Sandy Lyon and Emma Maris, two of the 21 landowners, tribal members, and other opponents of the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal and Pacific Connector Pipeline, who sat in at Governor Kate Brown's office on November 21st. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. We're going to go out with some music by Ashel Eldridge about the urban farm in Richmond called Urban Tilth. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Urban Tilth, grow your own, you know what I'm saying? Get down and dirty with it. If you grow it, they gon' eat it. Yeah.
Watch it, watch it, watch it grow, yeah. Watch it.